Next stop, Deflation Station.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. We're not there yet, but deflation gets closer every day. This morning, the government said consumer prices fell 1.7% last month. That's the biggest drop since February 1947. Of course, energy prices had a lot to do with it. They fell a record 17%. But prices in general are coming down. Now, that doesn't mean much unless it stays that way. A sustained lack of demand will cause deflation. What cures deflation? Besides spending, lowering interest rates will usually do the trick. But they're mighty close to zero already.
Zero?
Yeah. Zero is a wonderful thing. In fact, zero is my hero.
How can zero be a hero?
Well, I'm not sure it will be in this situation. The Fed will probably cut its rate today to near zero, but banks are already charging each other minuscule amounts for lending, so it probably won't make much difference. In the stock markets, the Dow is up a bit, a fraction, 82 points to 86.47. The NASDAQ has gained 1%, 22 points. The S&P 500 is up 11. In Asia today, the markets were mixed. European shares are a fraction higher so far. Among the Wall Street banks left, Goldman Sachs is the sturdiest. No quarterly losses since going public in 1999. Until this morning. Goldman lost about $5 a share, more than $2 billion last quarter. We're joined by a reporter in New York, Alisa Roth. Alisa, is this a sign of big trouble?
Not necessarily. I talked this morning with banking analyst Bert Ely, and he says you really have to put Goldman's losses into the broader context of what's been happening to banks and to Wall Street generally.
Everybody's performance in those companies involved in the financial markets are down. So one would expect Goldman to take some hits, but you know they still are performing quite well compared to many other financial companies.
Well, Alisa, it sounds like Goldman is in the best position among some of these banks. So what's the problem?
Well, part of it, as we just heard, is that the market itself is just in bad shape. And so even if you're the best of the bad, you're still not in a great position. Beyond that, Goldman Sachs just became a bank holding company. Now, it's a company that holds or controls a certain amount of shares in other banks. And ultimately, that should make it more stable, partly because it let it access funds from the Federal Reserve. But this is a whole new business model for Goldman. And the old one was built on leverage, and the company just can't hold that much risk anymore.
So in this new world for Goldman, what is its strategy going to be?
Well, the first strategy is trying to sell off assets and get some cash that way. It is looking to buy a bank, but apparently hasn't been able to find one that fits its needs and or it can afford. And meanwhile, they're trying to find other ways to cut back. So the executives have said they're not taking any bonuses this year. Something like 10% of the workforce has been laid off this year. And there have been rumors of more job cuts to come.
All right. Marketplace's Alisa Roth in New York. Thank you.
You're welcome.
This morning, Best Buy said its profit sank last quarter, and the company plans to offer buyout packages to nearly all of its corporate employees. Best Buy will also cut capital spending by 50% next year and open significantly fewer stores in the U.S., Canada, and China. This is the Morning Report for Tuesday, December 16th on Marketplace.org. There's a meeting today of the FDIC board. You know the FDIC as the safety net that covers your bank deposit up to $250,000. But your bank has to pay to be able to show that little sticker in the window. And the amount it shells out has to do with its assets. From North Carolina Public Radio, Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
By law, the FDIC is supposed to keep a minimum of 1.15% of insured deposits in reserve. They don't have that right now. So to get there, the FDIC will likely double bank assessment fees at today's meeting. Bank customers aren't told how much, but the exact amount each bank pays the FDIC depends on how risky its assets are. Professor Lisa Broom at the University of North Carolina says because of the financial crisis, highly leveraged banks will pay more than ever before.
I think the range will spread out so that there is more room to reward safe banks and more room to charge the banks that pose more risk.
The more cash and government securities on the bank's balance sheet, the less the FDIC payment and the less cost passed on to customers. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Congress has yet to sign off on most appropriations bills to fund federal agencies, and that includes funding the bill that gives lawmakers their raises. Even though it hasn't passed yet, the pay hike kicks in automatically next month. Danielle Carson explains.
Every January, like clockwork, lawmakers get their automatic pay raises. Next month, their incomes will go up 2.8% to $174,000. For Steve Ellis with Taxpayers for Common Sense, there's something wrong with this picture.
As you look across the country, you have Americans who are losing their jobs, aren't getting any holiday bonuses, and then you have Congress getting a pay raise. It really flies in the face of shared sacrifice.
Many members campaigned this year to eliminate automatic pay raises. It may have made for good politics, but Utah Democrat Jim Matheson has been the lone voice in the House protesting the pay hikes and is giving the extra cash to charitable groups.
There's no question that our current circumstances really call into question if this is the time for Congress to be raising its own pay. I use that term loosely because Congress didn't really do anything to raise its own pay. It just kind of happened.
Taxpayer advocate Steve Ellis says it's up to constituents to let their representatives know the automatic pay raises are not okay, especially now. In Washington, I'm Danielle Carson for Marketplace.
For young entrepreneurs, the current economy can seem pretty scary. After all, this is probably their first time they've been in business on their own during a serious recession. And it's definitely a learning opportunity, as Mitchell Hartman reports from the Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting.
Consider this. During the recession of the early 1980s, Bill Lynch was still in diapers. In the 90s recession, he was nerding out in middle school playing computer games. By the time Lynch and his best friend, Matt Tucker, landed jobs in Silicon Valley just out of college, the dot-com boom was well into its heyday and headed for a crash.
We started in 2001, right, and that was on the heels of the dot-com implosion.
What they started that year was Jive Software, a suite of online collaboration tools for business. Lynch says they were still pretty green, but they'd seen enough dot-com failure for an entrepreneurial lifetime.
The biggest takeaway from Matt and I were a set of anti-lessons, if you will. We're not going to do it this way. We're going to focus on a really great, viable product from the get-go. We're going to have a way to make money.
Jive Software now has 120 employees and offices in Portland, San Francisco, London, and Zurich. When the IT sector started looking sketchy this fall, they quickly downsized to get expenses in line with revenue.
The biggest risk is not taking action soon enough, or if you're going to cut anything, be it people or expenses, that you don't go deep enough, fast enough.
Riva Lazansky blogs about the startup economy for MSN Office Live. She says even though young entrepreneurs aren't seasoned by success and failure yet, they have some advantages over their elders.
They seem to like travel in packs, and they seem to just inherently share information with one another.
Translation, they understand the power of social networking and marketing on the internet. Lazansky says they also tend to be risk takers.
And I think it's really good to be a little bit fearless. When you start being fearful is when you start pulling back, and you never can grow your business with that attitude.
Of course, not all young entrepreneurs are the business equivalent of bungee jumpers. Zach Davis founded his web development company, Cast Iron Coding, a few years ago with a raft of student loans to pay off and a new baby on the way. Now he's heading into no man's land without a map.
Once you've been through this and gotten through it, you know that you're going to get through it, most likely again. I don't have that behind me.
Davis says business has been up every year since he launched, but he's not adding employees or taking on debt to expand until the economy turns around. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Let's say you've been appointed finance minister of a brand new country. You get to choose your economic model. With all the economic fallout of the previous few months, it'd be pretty hard to pick free market capitalism, wouldn't it? With that in mind, consider the plight of the former Eastern Bloc countries in Europe. Stephen Beard has our story.
In his home overlooking the Hungarian capital Budapest, opposition politician József Torgyan claims his country is in a bitter mood.
Hungarians feel today so bad, they feel so unhappy that they've never felt so bad during the whole history, I would say.
Bailed out by the IMF and sliding into recession, Hungary has been brought to its knees by debt, says Torgyan. Having overthrown communism 20 years ago, Hungary has swapped one tyranny for another.
Russian tanks left, but foreign banks came. That banks even robbed us more than those Russians who stayed here.
That claim sounds bizarre in a country where living standards have soared. But analyst Christian Svoboda says there is a growing distrust among Hungarians of free market economics.
They are absolutely afraid of the market. They are absolutely afraid of competition. Even the young generations think that if I personally have a problem, I must turn to the state to solve it.
He says that sentiment is spreading throughout Eastern Europe, even in Slovakia, a big free market success. Journalist Anka Dragu says Slovaks have been turned off by the inequality of American capitalism.
They just see, oh, that guy got millions, has a luxurious villa, and poor people were laid off now, and they have a hard time finding a job. This is the part of capitalism that they don't like.
With free market reforms reducing the role of the state, much of Eastern Europe was catching up with the West. But that could come to a halt, says Tomasz Walaczek of the Centre for European Reform in London.
The population is turning away from the free market liberal capitalist systems. It was doing that before, but the crisis is going to accelerate the trend.
Walaczek says that's not surprising. After all, he says, just look at the West. After preaching the virtues of balanced budgets and privatization, we're now running up record deficits and greatly expanding the role of the state. This is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Share your thoughts with us at marketplace.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. Thanks for tuning in and have a great day.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.